Hey everybody, this is Shop Talk Show, episode number 187, brought to you in part by UX Rebels Summit. The URL there is UXRebelsPluralSummit.com. It's one of the Environments for Humans online conferences coming up November 17th. It's a one-day virtual conference about leveling up your UX skill and design set. Learn about what should be in your UX portfolio, help land clients, what tools and gadgets you should use for field research, and much more. Check out UXRebelsSummit.com. And also brought to you in part by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK with one simple integration. Your customers get every way to pay. Learn more and try out the sandbox at braintreepayments.com/shoptalk. Oh, we'll tell you more about both of those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off. Boom. Bum, 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 bum.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, podcast all about front-end web design, development, fart sounds, and more. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris, the code pennerinator.
Yeah, click and tap
the tap event, brothers.
The click events, brothers. What was the official spec called? The pointer events.
Oh yeah, we should advocate the pointer events. We should be squeaky wheels for that.
Those are good. We should have them. I think it's headed in that direction. Anyway, this is episode number 187, which is our 51st rapid fire episode, and you guys know what that means. It means that we're not going to dwell on too much intro stuff here. We're going to get right to the questions that you folks have sent in. No guests, no drama, no stuff. So let's just do that because that's what we promised to do. We'll alternate the reading of them. I'll kick it off here with Amy Etheridge, who writes in, I've been developing for the past few years, first casually, nice, and then in the past month, professionally, yay! One thing I'm finding difficult is to be able to read other people's code, which is something that I find pretty much unavoidable. I'm a master at watching videos and reading formally about languages, but those don't usually encompass everything that you could run into. When I Google around for answers, I want to understand why they are working and not just do the copy and paste. A common problem I have is knowing if the things are inherent to the language or just a construct of this particular developer. Any tips on how to better decipher and read other people's code? Dave?
That's a good question, and I'm afraid I'm maybe not the best of help because I took 3 computer science courses at my university. So I feel like I learned how to read code via computer science and then repeatedly reading code throughout my whole like adult life. So
would you say that it's a known problem that it's much harder to wrap your head around other people's code than it is, say, looking back on your own code? Or
yeah, I mean my code's perfect and flawless, you know, so it's really easy. Everyone says, Dave, your code's very easy to read, I'm pretty sure. But no, I think it's just styles, you know. There, some people just kind of riff and make really short variable names. And there are some best practices to make your code more readable, you know, very clear variable names, you know.
And even possibly even more important than variable names is like function names.
Function names.
And how you abstract those functions. And I was alluding to the fact, Amy, that I think everyone has some trouble with this. People make different mm-hmm. choices about how to abstract things, and coding is all about abstractions. And the fact that somebody else has abstracted things in a different way than you would have is sometimes very difficult. And I think being able to code and reading other people's code are very related skills, but also very different. and just it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. To just bring up a chunk of code and look at it and reason about it, as they say, and figure out exactly what it's doing is a unique skill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then trying to figure out like what's a core part of the language and what's like somebody's addition or
right.
Own code. That's tough.
Or does this come from a particular library or framework kind of thing? Yeah, and Amy, you voiced that here. That is particularly difficult to be like, is this native JavaScript or is this an abstraction of the authors or is this an abstraction of a library that they're using? Yeah, that's a bit hard to know. And it doesn't seem like something that generally qualifies as a code comment. You know, so that's kind of a classic thing to it. Is the code well documented? You wouldn't leave a code comment that says, hey, this function that I'm using here, this is from Backbone or whatever. That seems, you know, a bit overkill generally for code. So, but, you know, and I think the onus is on tutorial writers more so than like if you're finding it hard to go to a tutorial and reason about what they're doing, that's kind of a poor tutorial. And it's yeah, just a side.
Well,
point
and
there.
It's probably even like Stack Overflows and stuff like that. Just, you know, here's your solution. I wrote it. Just use this, you know, and not explaining like this is like a core part of jQuery or this is a core part of Angular. I mean, I was probably 7 years of writing JavaScript before I realized it had math built in, like a whole math class that does all your math. I don't know. I never really put it together that I could use that. And I think it's, you know, it's a lot of Googling. There is sort of like what's core to the language is usually named very boring and kind of ugly, like Git client bounding wrecked.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But consistently kind of like fuddy-duddy, if I'm going to use that word correctly, it is just sort of like, that doesn't sound like a human named it. That's kind of a good sign it's from the language itself. But, you know, and if it's very clever, like awesome script dude or flipper thing, that's usually like somebody's
that's a good point. Yeah, and then maybe there's a naming convention as well, like if you see like an underscore before a function name or something, that's almost certainly authored thing.
And I think that's I think React is kind of doing that. I saw somebody present on React recently and they kind of underscored all their functions that they wrote just to kind of say like, hey, I wrote this. Mm-hmm. This is not a part of the you know, this is code I'm liable for. A private function, I guess you'd call it.
I think practice is going to make perfect for you, Amy, or, you know, that's possibly an exaggeration. But yeah, I've known people that have had little mini businesses saying, I'll read your code and give you feedback on it. And they made a business out of it because they know that that's such a difficult thing to do that they were uniquely qualified to do and have lots of experience doing. So,
yeah, but it's practice. It's really just tearing through reams of code. I mean, you'll find yourself in a position where, you know, you're debugging a WordPress plugin or something and you have to read the whole plugin line by line. And you just acclimate to other people's code, how they do parentheses, how they do brackets and semicolons. And you just kind of learn. But that's where I think, I don't know, pair programming would be helpful too, if you can set that up or even just meet people at a coffee shop to code in your town, because then you can kind of like see people's code and how they do it and you kind of build a tolerance for crappy code, which is okay.
Well, you know, you don't have to necessarily keep it all in your brain either. I mean, that's a particular skill too, to be able to reason about code and kind of, you know, eyeball track it through. Okay, this thing is getting passed down here and over here, and it comes back like this. But you don't necessarily have to do that either. Remember, console.log is your friend, or printing out variables to the screen, or whatever kind of console, or even you know, visually out to the web page. Certainly, that can help you reason about code too. It's just a be constantly kind of printing out what values are what and where and when. And getting good at the dev tools too can be helpful, particularly in JavaScript land, setting breakpoints and inspecting things. Anyway, lots to talk about there. Let's move on to John Schmidt's audio question.
Here we go.
Hey guys, love the show. Thanks for doing it. I have a question about managing your local WordPress setup. For a while, I've used just one WordPress install and one database, and then I switched to whatever theme I'm working on at the time. That's nice because it's just one place to manage, but it can get pretty messy content-wise. I was wondering how you do it, or have done it, when working in an environment like that. Do you have separate installs and a database for each project? I'd love to hear your input on this. Thanks so much again.
Chris, you might be a good...
Yes, definitely. I've that seems really impressive almost to me that has worked for you ever, John. Not to be weird, but to have one install with just different themes that represent each of your products, I find, install to install is more different than that. It's not just the theme that changes from WordPress site to WordPress site. It's like the content itself, of course, like you alluded to, but it's what plugins are active, which is a really big deal. And just, all kinds of stuff. What are even the settings within WordPress itself are, to have those be consistent across every single WordPress site you work on, I would find highly rare. So yeah.
I've tried to do the GodPress.
Well, if you're going to do that, do a local multi-site install.
That's what I think is the solution. I think I have like 10 WordPresses from his time immemorial and they're all stuck in MAMP somewhere, and I have to like turn it back on and, update it all. I think it might be better if I just worked in one multi-site, and set that up locally.
And that's cool. The problem with that being that that's not the setup that the live site is in probably. So then you have a different local than live install. I don't find it that'd be great for me. And if I could go back in time and all of the WordPress sites I work on that are my life were a multi-site install, and even then I'm not sure. Cause what is it for me? It's like CSS Tricks and the Shop Talk Show site and the CodePen blog and stuff. I don't think those things should be on one multi-place install. They're different business entities. Who knows what the future of all of them are? And it's probably not appropriate. But, John, I would separate those things out locally. So you have different databases for each of them. We've had a sponsor before on Chop Talk Show with the WP DB Migrate
DB
Pro.
Migrate Pro.
That's great for the databases, having something like Beanstalk or whatever do the deployment of it. And somebody was... What you probably I always find it interesting, what's in the Git repo for a WordPress install. For a lot of my sites, I just put the entire thing in there. That's what we do for Shop Talk Show, for example. And that seems a little heavy handed because the world needs another entire WordPress stall and a Git repo kind of thing. I've seen ones where just the plugins and the themes are in Git, which I think is a smart way to break it off. So maybe I guess it's just kind of just the WP content folder is that, and the WordPress install isn't in the Git repo. But I think it even does some smarter stuff than that. That's kind of a cool way to go. But yeah, definitely would try to make your local install as much like the live install as possible. And I think generally sites are different enough that, imagine you're running the plugin, the really common one for the custom fields one, advanced custom fields. You can't have that set up in such a way that it works for every single different possible site. I think that's just too weird. And it's not that bad to host them separately. So keep them separate, John.
That's a good word. I think because MAMP makes it super easy. So just
your URLs could be different.
Oh, all right. Okay. Pew, pew, pew. Next question. Chris, you want to take
Dan L writes in, what's the cure for imposter syndrome? Ooh, I guess we could just stop it there, but he goes on to elaborate. I've been working in the industry for about 8 years, and I like to think I'm fairly up to date on the latest and greatest front-end tools, but as a self-taught designer developer, and especially one that follows a lot of brilliant computer science people on Twitter, it often feels like I'm a legit education away from knowing what I'm talking about. I don't know if either of us are doctors or psychologists or something, but I think I understand imposter syndrome to be that you look around the room you're in and you're like, how am I here? I don't know anything. everybody else seems to know lots of stuff. I'm just faking it to make it here, and it can feel daunting and scary and right. Isn't that generally the?
That's the vibe of it, is that you have feelings of inadequacy because you are not, you perceive yourself not at the level of everyone else around you, right? Is that, or maybe straight up you aren't, and you're there and you're like,
well, that's the danger, is that it feels so real because maybe you aren't. And that's kind of the danger. But I think that this possible, I don't know what the solution to it is, but for one, it's to talk about it and be aware of it. So the fact that you're aware of it is a step towards fighting it, I think, because I think a lot of people have this and aren't aware that there's a word for it and don't. And that it's a little bit like, what do you call that? When you think you have some weird disease all the time or whatever. It's kind of a
hypochondriac.
Sure. I think it's more along the lines of that than it is a real deal thing. And that just being kind of aware of that is helpful, and talking about it a bunch, because it's so many people feel this way that it can't be true for all of them. You know,
I read this good Medium article that had a nice little twist on it. And it said, you don't have imposter syndrome. You just have a bad case of reality. Because like, you can't know everything. Like, literally, no one can know everything. And there may be know-it-all-y people, like smarties, that I would like get the palm sweats around, like John Rezik or something, or Raquel Velez. It's just like, they're very smart and I'm a very dumb, I make a fart podcast, that like, I feel that in their presence. But like, it's just reality. You can't know everything. And I thought that was a good take on it. It's like, everyone kind of has it. It is this kind of like just straight up, we can't know everything. So that's just the baseline experience for everyone. So I think that's why it is a popular.
Hopefully it kind of comes and goes in waves a bit too. I mean, I just published a post on CSS Strikes, a guest post on a JavaScript topic, basically kind of how to fake classes in JavaScript. I'm like, this, I feel like I've been writing JavaScript for a long time now, years and years and years. I feel like I should be able to tech check this article. I mean, I'm a tech journalist practically. I've written dozens, if not hundreds, of tutorials on JavaScript. And I look at this stuff and I'm like, I don't know. This is just out of my wheelhouse. This isn't how I write JavaScript. I don't think about JavaScript in this way. It's a little unusual to me. And I felt weird about that. Like, as somebody in a position that I'm in, like, I have to punt on this. It was a weird moment to me, but I've felt this and I've kind of worked through this enough in my mind that I'm okay with it. There is lots of writing on this. It's probably worth a roundup of different opinions on this, of being like, yeah, the healthy dose of reality is a good one. I read one by Laura Hogan that said, don't stop leaning on imposter syndrome. Because if you think about it too much and kind of call it into conversation too much, it can be weird. For example, I think she was going to give a talk somewhere and felt like, I'm not sure I have much to kind of add to this conversation or something like that. And then one of her friends is a huge supporter of Laura said, oh, that's just your imposter syndrome talking. She's like, you know, in this case, thank you so much for believing in me. But in this case, I think I'm right. You know, I think I'm allowed to know what I can do and I can't do. So if I say I can't do something, maybe I can't do it. Like, don't just say, oh, you got imposter syndrome every single time somebody thinks they can't do something. Like, knowing your strengths and weaknesses is a valuable thing. And you can't chalk up everything you don't know to imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think actually having imposter syndrome is a good place. I think the inverse of that, where you have this like maximum bravado and you're just like, yes, I can do that. Like,
sure. It's some sense, like, of humbleness or that comes along with it. That's a good thing to have.
Yeah. Just this like awareness that you are not like, you don't know everything. I think that's a good place to be in, rather, because the opposite is very scary to me. Like, somebody who's just like, yeah, I can control a satellite with JavaScript. You're just like, that seems hard. Okay. Like, just the there's, I don't know. I have, strong feelings about the other side. So I think, you know, I think you can hurt yourself career-wise and like, you know, like you're too afraid to talk about something somebody's already talked about. Don't stop feeling those feelings. Like just get up there and do your job and do your, you be you. Is that, that's bad advice. I mean,
if it's an overwhelming feeling that you don't deserve to be where you are, that's the one that you want to fight against. Because you do deserve it, because somebody's given you the job. You've been doing this for 8 years, as you said. You know, you feel up to date with the latest and greatest front-end tools and trends. You know how many people don't feel that way? I mean, you're probably way ahead of the curve here, Dan. So, and just the fact that you know about it and there's a word for it, I think you're on your way to being healthy. All right. Alex Z writes in.
Alex Z, I am enjoying my time with Adam's text editor, but one thing that has me a little confused is adding syntax highlighting. I have read some tutorials, but it seems a little complicated. I am looking to add syntax highlighting for Haml. Any advice? Well, I guess this is defers to me as the native
local Adam expert. Yeah, I haven't spent much time with Adam, but I did. I mean, I just Googled, you know, syntax highlighting Haml for Atom, and there appears to be a Haml package for Atom. It has a screenshot of syntax highlighted Haml and Atom. It seems fairly straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, the language packages are typically language hyphen Haml or language hyphen PHP or something.
In this case, it's language hyphen Haml.
And that is pretty much what you need to get things going.
You know, I remember in Sublime Text, there's a package manager, but the package manager itself doesn't come with Sublime. You have to add it to Sublime. But then once you have it, it's very easy to add a new package, search for a package. You just type Haml in there. You'd probably get it. You'd click the button. You'd restart Sublime, and then you have Haml. Does Atom come with a package manager as you download it?
Yep, package manager is built in, and actually, like, Atom itself is a very thin shell, and they pre-install packages. So a lot of what makes Atom work is a pre-install kind of thing.
So is there a obvious way to add a new package to Atom? It's just a menu item or something?
Command-Shift-P or Control-Shift-P if you're on Windows. And then you just – it takes a little – it's actually not, like, the first thing that comes up, so you have to do, like – install packages or something. You have to kind of
because there's other your commands of packages. There might be
install
remove package.
Package. Yeah. Yep. And so then you get to the right one, and then it's just install package, search package. You search one. You can also search themes. There's a little theme toggle.
Funny, the UI is so similar to Sublime.
Oh, it's a straight rip, but it's so good. It's so much better. It has little tiny icons for you. Oh, it's beautiful. But then there's also a package thing. That's your like installed one. But yeah, there's like core packages, community packages, and you can even write your own packages. It's a package town. The install, it's really easy. And then you one click install, it doesn't even have to reboot. It's like installed straight away. And then you may want to reopen your Haml file, but it should just straight up apply. Here, I'm working on a markdown file here. I'm going to go install a package for language markdown. How's that sound?
Pretty good. You don't have syntax highlighting for it right now in Atom?
I haven't done anything. Let's see, language.
I kind of like it. I use the IA writer though, which kind of has this own way of doing things that I really like. Cool. So that seems language. fairly straightforward. Alex, good luck with the Atom editor. Dave, would you say that? Let us know how this goes, by the way, as you're doing it live. Do you feel like in the 1 year from now, Atom will have overtaken at least our little bubble in, I haven't switched to it yet, but I wonder if Sublime Text is going to hold on as the kind of the predominant. I feel like it's still kind of number one, at least in my bubble. And I wonder if Atom will take it over, if Sublime will hang on.
One can only hope. No, I think there's room for diversity. I like Atom. I've actually been using Visual Studio Code. We kind of talked about this in the Dave Goes Windows episode, but I've been using it more since that episode. And now this is a new competitor because it has like diff splits. It has merge tools. It has like everything built in. So it's kind of very interesting to me. That's something to think about there. So,
okay. Well, speaking of Dave Goes Windows, let's talk about that in a little bit. But first, I want to tell you about the UX Rebels Summit. So Rebels, plural, the URL being UX Rebels Summit, two S's next to each other. And that one, that'll get you where you need to go. It's an Environments for Human online conference. So attend the UX Rebels Summit without the travel hassle. No need to book a flight to see great speakers and learn so much while you're at the office or home office or wherever in the world you feel like watching this thing. You can do that. People are going to expect that you're free and hassle you while you attend. That's okay, because the recordings come free with Environments for Human conferences. So if you're just, you know, if people know you're at home, your Slack bubble is green or whatever, I think you can customize that color. It's red in our little Slack. That's how I know Dave's online. But, you know, Dave might be like, hey, man, what are you doing? And I'll be like, stop bothering me. I'm at the UX Rebel Summit. Or I might just take a break and talk to Dave for a minute, knowing that I can go back and watch the UX Rebel Summit's recordings, which come free with your ticket to it, which is nice. If you want to go to UX Rebels Summit, use coupon code CHOPTALKSHOW for 20% off the registration. That would be the smart way to go. So it's just a one-day online conference, and it's all about UX, which is just the hugest thing ever, the most important thing in our industry, presumably. So if there's people out there that consider UX a big part of their job, or you're just straight up, you're a UX person, probably the conference for you, including very important topics like designing your UX portfolio, which I think is pretty interesting, because what goes in a UX portfolio? Are you allowed to like put in the designs of site you worked on even though you weren't the designer? Or how do you like make that clear? That does seem a little confusing to me. Things you should definitely not do with your portfolio. Ian Fenn is going to talk about that. Pamela Pavlicek, sorry, I've seen Pamela talk before and she's amazing, and she's doing a talk on designing for happiness. I feel bad because I think I probably screwed up her last name, is my thing that I do on this show. UX is UI, designing your design team, which I think is really interesting. In fact, I think we're going to have a guest on as soon as I can get her on talking about that. Anyway, you can hear it all happen on November 17th. Use coupon code CHOPTALKSHOW and go to UXRebelsSummit.com. Let's do another one.
Another one. All right, here we go. Tim Rourke writes in. This is about Dave Goes Windows. This one relates to Dave Goes Windows. It's a simple one, but important. Dave, what are you doing about managing file paths in your applications? Have you run into any problems with node dependencies choking trying to find a file using /  instead of /?
So let's stop there for a second. Does the Windows really do that? The file paths have the wrong, or not wrong, but a different direction
it's different. It's the opposite. And I don't know why. It's probably a history thing. But I have not had any problems. And my spidey sense is people have gone in to great lengths to fix that, to kind of trans-interpolate that, you know?
Sure. Seems like a regex solvable kind of problem.
Yeah, perhaps. I think so. Because I can actually type the wrong /, and like, you know, auto-complete it in my terminal or my command prompt, and it will flip it for me. It'll be like, oh yeah, you meant this one. And it's like, oh, okay, that's great. I don't know about Node. No, I think Node has it all figured out as well. I think Windows
so
team
that's
is
problem solved. And I thought this one was funny because at the beginning of the show we were talking. You're like, I think I want to do a quick little segment to tell people about my success of getting my dev environment set up. And Tim Rourke, writing this question, says, what's it like these days to get Ruby up and running on Windows? And I guess you know. So this is your opportunity, Dave, to tell the world.
Oh boy. So Ruby is great. Ruby gets going bing, boom, bing. You just do rubyinstaller.org. There's a little thing. There's a dev kit thing that helps.
Ruby's
like,
no big
compile
deal.
Rails
is the problem.
Rails was a big problem. And if in Dave Goes Windows, the last episode we recorded of Shop Talk Show, we just talked about this. And having problems.
It's just like, it's not possible at the moment.
Yeah, I can't use Rails. I can't build day trip on my Windows box. But like 2 days after recording that, I went for it. I was like, I'm just going to do a clean install from scratch, like a brand new Rails app, and just try to get it up and running. And there had been a few improvements, like updates to gems. And I had to manually patch the SQLite 3 gem. Like I had to download some guy's version of it and load that gem instead of the other one. And then I had to use a pre-release gem, which is not super foreign in Ruby land. Like that's a pretty normal thing to do, to use a release candidate. But so that should be on the way for Nokogiri, which is the XML parser. So that is actually going to come in Nokogiri 1.67 and fix it. But if you're deploying to Heroku or something like that, you need the Puma gem, and Puma 2.13.4 was broken, but now Puma is at 2.14.0. So it fixed their problems in Puma. So it works. So like I can deploy to Heroku with one gem fix, which is that Nokogiri pre-release version. So that's all it takes.
You're back. You on your Microsoft Surface can work on your Ruby on Rails app, and all is well with the world.
Yep. I am like very thrilled, because I think I was switching between computers, like trying to do like just daily stuff on one and then kind of switching over to Mac to do some other stuff or to do Rails work mostly. And I was just getting stressed out. You know, I'm sure you feel that.
I'm a one dev environment or one machine kind of man myself too at the moment.
One machine. Right. Well, and I think that's what, I think that's what God intended, is one machine. When you're bouncing between machines, it's almost like when you're bouncing between your phone and your tablet and your desktop, you're just kind of like, every time you switch, you build a little bit of stress, you know? You're just kind of like, where's that thing? What machine was I working on this thing? And I think I was feeling that. So I'm really happy to be over on like Windows only. So, that's it. So I'm very happy about that.
Wonderful. I think we'll save some of this Windows stuff, and we'll kind of sprinkle it in throughout episodes and track Dave's life on the Windows world, which seems like it's pretty interesting and not that different. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's all web development.
Mm-hmm.
So Josh Fabian writes in, I'm the leader at my small shop of 14 people, so I'm always trying to come up with cool ways to make the team more efficient and bring everyone's skill up. I was recently thinking about implementing coding style guides to help unify our code. Okay, my questions are, is this even a good idea? There hasn't really been any issues of people writing terrible code, but there's been a couple of different styles throughout the office, which can sometimes take a minute to figure out how they coded it. I'm concerned this will make me look like a ruthless dictator who implements rules to feel power. So I guess we could stop there. Josh, your main question here is, or your lead was, that you're trying to come up with ways for the team to be more efficient and to bring everyone's skill up. Why don't you, instead of implement this from on high, make it a goal for the team? Give someone else this job, or ask it of everyone at once. Can we be more consistent with the code we write? What do you all think? Can somebody take the lead on this kind of thing? Because then it's you're accomplishing the goal of getting a consistent style guide, and you're getting more efficiency, and you're leveling up the team's ability to work together and make decisions together and implement style guides. And doesn't that seem like a win-win?
It might even make sense to just find three people on that team and get them to come to consensus before you try to get 14 people to come to consensus, because that's hard. And then maybe they go out and kind of evangelize, hey, does this sit well with you? Like if we all coded the same way and linted it. And
sure. And that's part two of the question is, do you have suggestions on a good way to do this? I'm thinking about a linter on save through Grunt could do the trick possibly. And you know, sure, that's one way to implement a linter. Another way is, I'm sure Adam has linters. You can build right into it. I know at CodePen we use a JS, ECMAScript hinter kind of thing that does it as you type, and we use RuboCop for on the Rubo side to kind of enforce standards as you type. That's kind of nice because it's, I don't know, it warns you right as you're typing rather than on save. Just seems better to me. I don't know.
Yep.
So there's lots of ways to implement a linter. It could be part of your commit. You know, there's a million ways to kind of get feedback on that. But is that a good way to go, you think?
I think it's a good way. There was not a good SCSS SAS linter for like a node-based one until recently. Snugug just made one, Sam Richards.
Well, that's nice because I know a lot of people write in SAS and to not have any kind of linting ability for. I mean, there's plenty of CSS ones, right? So you could lint it after that and see if the compiled, but that's no good. You know, you want to be linting your authored code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So pure Node.js SAS linting is now out. It's sastools/sas-lint. Check it out.
That's great. And these are then dot files. So you pull a repo and your code editor theoretically looks at the dot file, which is just a way to configure stuff, right? And then it's
rules.
You know, rules.
It's like this on, this off, this on, this off.
Exactly. And then that's what goes through your office. So to hand that down to somebody on your team that's maybe never done that before, that's bringing their skill level up. They're understanding a new configuration kind of thing. They can... that seems like the way to do it is perhaps for you not to lead this project, Josh.
Yeah. It's tough too. Cause if you create work, like if it's now a burden for everyone, like people might peace out on you and that would be a nightmare scenario for like creating turnover by code standards. But, hopefully everyone sees the benefit, which is the just thinking less about doing code. We now have, if you set a standard, everyone has to think less, you know, about how they indent and stuff like that. And that may bum people out, but you can, if everyone's thinking less and less cleaning is involved around the house, then like you have more time for fun stuff later. If the room is clean, you can do more fun stuff. Clean your room. That's code dad. Hashtag code dad. Hey, clean your code. No playing until you clean your code. That's my new Vine character, Code Dad. Oh, coming out 2016.
At Code Dad on Twitter. I want to tell you a little bit about Braintree, and the URL there is Braintree. Is it Braintree? I know it's BraintreePayments.com. The one you want to go to, though, is BraintreePayments.com/shoptalk. That's the cool URL to go to, and that's the one where you're going to save. You're not going to be charged for your first $50,000 in transactions if you go to it, which is pretty cool.
Whoa.
I don't know how much you know about Braintree, but the point is that it's...
Chris, is Braintree a tree made of brains?
I can't sleep now, Dave. Well, but it's very smart and okay, let's make an analogy. It's a set of APIs that are very smart and they branch out to handle lots of different payment types. Oh gosh.
Wow. Oh. That's going to earn you a sound effect, Chris. I just got to find it on the old board here. Hold on.
I just did a Tina.
Dang.
Okay, that's acceptable.
That was worth it. Okay.
Some of the branches on their API might be PayPal. So you have one API and now you're accepting payments via PayPal. Through that same API, through no work on your part, you now also support Apple Pay. Oh, that's pretty cool, huh? Mm-hmm. And your mobile app? Yeah. Coinbase. So you're taking Bitcoin now. So for a particular audience, people that prefer to pay in that way, great, you take Bitcoin. And it doesn't mean that you have to then have like a bank of Bitcoin. All this happens and it just turns into regular money or whatever. I take Android Pay, take Venmo, all that stuff through one API. So it just seems like kind of the way to go, not to mention like credit cards, you know. It seems like you want to support all these things. It's the way to go. And it's a PayPal company now because they weren't and then they got bought, which is the smartest move PayPal ever did because, yay, Braintree rules. Simple, secure payments you can integrate in minutes. Don't worry about taking days to integrate your payments with Braintree. It's literally done in minutes. They have this thing where it's like they have little examples in all the languages: Net, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby. It's like 10 lines of code, and you put it in there, and you're taking payments. I mean, it's on you to kind of deal with the API results and stuff and do what you're going to do in your application for a user that's paid or not paid or behind in payment or whatever. But the actual payment part is very, very easy, and it's super awesome, and I absolutely love that they sponsor this podcast. Braintree, clap, clap, clap. Hashtag yay. Cool. Let's do some more question stuff. We have an audio one here that comes in from Amanda Mitchell.
Should I declare language in my HTML documents, or is that unnecessary, assuming that I'm going to be targeting an English audience and I'm only going to have English content?
All right. So I think the question is, should we use the language attribute on the HTML, like HTML lang equals EN?
First of all, I think exactly. It's literally an attribute, and you usually put it on the HTML tag itself in your HTML document. So HTML lang equals, and then EN usually for English, or I think if there's subvariants, it's EN colon something else. And that works that way for all the languages, and you could probably find a list we could link to of all the different languages and what it sub are they dialects. I don't know that much about it, but I think it's required to be valid HTML these days. I think missing the lang attribute makes for invalid HTML. I don't know what the repercussions of that is. It's just kind of, you know, do you want your
In screen reader land, there are some very big repercussions, like actually the voice may even change, you know, if you're ES or EN-US or EN-GB for Great Britain, it'll change. Like it can, the way it pronounces things and the way it kind of contextualizes things. This is just very English specific. I think, you know, if you rolled without it, things would figure it out. It probably defaults to whatever the user has as a language on their system. But you know, if you run a Spanish site and my screen reader goes to it, it probably will, without the language attribute, my screen reader will sound very gringo trying to read like Telemundo.com. And so I think there is purpose for it. I think you should put
it in. Here's one. User agents can and do use the language information to select language appropriate fonts, which improves the overall experience for the page. For example, a page encoded in Unicode text in simplified Chinese, traditional Chinese, Japanese, Korean may share the same code point for an ideographic character. This gets complicated quickly, but the point is, if you set the right language, a user agent might be like, oh, I see, I'm going to need to use this font variant to make sure that all of the characters are handled correctly and look correctly and look at home to people using that language. There's also a colon lang CSS selector that you can use. That's probably the appropriate one to use in CSS. So that's kind of available to you if you use the attribute. I think you also asked about, should I use it as an attribute on the HTML tag or do it through meta tag? I think the meta tag way is kind of old school, and the proper and correct way to do it is through the attribute on elements, which you could do for the whole document. And remember that if there's a subsection of a document that's a different language, you can use it on that sub element as well.
Well, and if you go, you know, like if you switch it into Hebrew, it'll flip around. So HE-IL, it'll flip it. It started left to right now, right to left. So there are things. I think when it's non-English, I think you start hitting things very, when there's a non-English market, I think you start hitting real reasons you want to include that. So,
but, and there's a great page on w3.org, and it's basically titled "Why Use the Language Attribute." It's saying that search engines might recognize the language it's in and do better for improving the quality of search. Be like, oh, I see, this is a Spanish page. I'm going to rank it higher on Spanish results. You know, it just kind of gives it a hint that that's happening. You know, that those in browser spelling and grammar checkers and stuff, that tends to work better and stuff, even on content editable attributes and stuff, if the language is set properly. Translation tools work better, like accessibility things work better. It talks about Braille translation and stuff here and needing to know what language it's in for that to work properly. Lots of stuff. So I guess we'll put this link in there because that is just the tip of the iceberg of reasons why you should do this. And apparently there are so many that it seems like a no-brainer not to. Or it seems like a no-brainer that you should absolutely use that attribute.
And then meta, you want meta car set UTF equals UTF-8? Yeah, you're going to want a meta. That actually has like kind of...
That is a meta. Questions.
Yeah. Yep. Well, cool. All right. Hopefully that helps. Next question.
Robert Kyatt writes in, could you briefly talk about the different apps that you can use to install SaaS? I'm using Windows, and I'd love to increase my workflow using SaaS. I'm mainly interested in the nested media queries thing. I figured that would make my workflow easier. So that it is an interesting thing, isn't it? People talk about SaaS, but the way that it works in any given workflow can be quite different from each other. I remember when I first learned SaaS, there was... a live reload app was the very first way I ever used it, I think. And then there's been various like GUIs, you know, little actual applications that watch your folders and do all that stuff. The most popular one right now in Mac land, I'd say, is CodeKit. And there are apps that kind of have largely followed in the footsteps or whatever of CodeKit and other things like it on the Windows side. I can't remember the names of them, but... So that's one way to do it, is like have an app that works for you. Of course, SaaS just works on the command line. SaaS, you know, you can have Grunt and Gulp and Broccoli and all these other kind of things run SaaS for you. So there is so many ways. I guess we could go through them all slowly, but I wonder, Dave, did you have any, I mean, I assume you use SaaS occasionally. Does Daytrip use SaaS?
Yeah, oh, totally. And that's all included in the Rails pipeline, just through a Ruby gem
Rails, install SaaS. That's another way I forgot to even mention.
So like if you gem install SaaS, you have SaaS on your computer. So that it that's pretty cool. There are things for Windows. Pre-Pros is actually cross-platform, but it's such a beautiful app. I would download it. If you're looking for a code kit kind of thing, I actually had the wonderful experience of compiling my own libsass locally on Windows, and that's pretty tough. You need to like install like all of Visual Studio, the like community edition, but you need to install like all of it. And then you like open up this little project or you download this folder into your root, and then you open up this project, and then you click a button to compile it, and then it's done. And then you have libsass locally. But that was sort of shocking that it, like, I was getting into like it, when you like gem install or do it all by the command line, you know, it compiles stuff, but it happens like before your eyes, you know, or it just happens like in reams of console code and you don't really notice that you're compiling. It was a neat experience to like be like, oh, I have to like make this project. I have to like manually create this dependency. It was neat, but I learned a lot. So
at the ground floor, if you're using Ruby SaaS, which is still, I believe, the canonical version of up-to-date SaaS, and I know there's the C version that you just talked about, but and they're trying to become kind of feature parity, and they're close, I think, but maybe not all the way. No matter what version of SaaS you're using, at the ground floor is this gem install SaaS kind of thing. So some whatever you're using, somewhere along the line on the bottom floor, it's doing that. And then, so let's say you're using Rails or whatever. That's you didn't specifically gem install SaaS, but you're just using Rails, so that just kind of came along for the ride. So that's just kind of works. But you could have just used SaaS just by itself, and then there's tools that come along with that, like SaaS Watch and stuff. So you can still have a little workflow with just the way ground floor thing. Then there's the framework thing like Rails. Then there's, let's say you're using Pre-Pros or CodeKit or any number of other ones, at some level inside its little app, they do that too. They have a little version of Ruby that runs internally to that app, and they process your thing through that. So, you know, it's just like developer convenience on top of that. Then there's what was the final way? Gosh, I can't even remember all the ways. But they, you know, they're just different developer conveniences for these ways. And oh, the grunt and gulp and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And those just install wrappers to run it.
Right. But the core way is basically still gem install SAS.
Well, hopefully that helps. All right, next question comes from Chris Bell. I have a client that is pushing for their site to have top scores on PageSpeed Insights. It calls the CSS before the head tag. Is this some way of improving speed or tricking Google Insights into throwing the CSS above the fold issues?
So apparently PageSpeed Insights wants you to do that thing where you put a chunk of your CSS into the head in style tags because it's kind of rendering above the fold CSS or whatever, which was kind of all the rage a little bit. I haven't heard people talking about it a lot recently, but I think it's kind of melted into a somewhat of a best practice.
Yeah, I have issues, but anyway, it is so. Yeah, it is kind of the you put a block of inline CSS in the head
of
your
name. It I forget what it's the
critical path CSS. Rendering or CSS, critical CSS. So you put your critical CSS in, which is a block of inline CSS to render the fold of your web page. And then you use JavaScript or to at the bottom of your page to inject a CSS tag that has all the styles, or maybe it's the styles from your head ripped out. It's like a style sheet to render the rest of your page. It is... yeah, in PageSpeed Insights,
it's pretty great. Like, right?
It's done well. It's fast as heck. I mean, I'm doing it on my site. I mean,
like packet that your browser receives, it has enough information because it theoretically has the entire HTML document, and it has enough CSS to kind of lay that document out. For the most part, it's going to be missing a lot of stuff, but it's the stuff that you can see and look at. And so that's what's so kind of great about it. This is kind of great for performance. And it looks like you're finding that PageSpeed Insights asks this of you. And if you don't do it, you kind of get dinged for it. And your client is like, why am I getting dinged for this? Why aren't you doing this for me? Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so that so you have to do that now. Good luck. No, there are some tools to help you. Adi Asmani and Filament Group have a bunch of tools for this.
The idea being you could do it all by yourself if you wanted to, but it's kind of nice to not do it as an author and let a tool do it for you. That's the big...
Yeah, let a tool do it for you. And my beef, what grinds my gears? Mm-hmm, what grinds my gears? Mm-hmm.
Is Code Dad, let's hear it.
Code Dad, you have to generate a critical CSS for every single page, right? Or every single template. So your index, your single, your category, because every page has a different first module that shows up on the page. Your first module in your document is different. It's the header and then your first module. So you need a critical CSS for every single variant of that. And then I think the best practice is you don't duplicate that in your CSS. You strip that out of your the duplicate styles out of your CSS. So now you need a critical CSS file for every single template. And then you have to lazy load JavaScript to lazy load the CSS in. So then you have to have there's a lot of work. And even for a small website like the Paravel Inc. portfolio, you have this kind of a lot of work to make it happen right on every single page. And for me, that was kind of getting overwhelming. So I kind of backed off from it. Ooh, I know that's terrible, but I was having trouble. And then an experience from being on Windows, I noticed Chrome and Firefox are awesome at critical CSS. They just fart out the page really quick. It's wonderful. But Chrome is the most noticeable. Chrome and WebKit is because you see the page kind of assemble in Herc-Gurk. And so it was like So if I want to avoid the herk jerk render on every single page load, now I'm getting into cookies. So now I'm managing a state. So I have a weirdly coded web page if you show up for the first time, and then I have a normally coded web page for if you show up the second time.
Right, because you don't need the critical CSS the second time because the CSS is cached and that's fast enough.
Yeah, and so I'm like, I don't know, man. I think this is a very cool thing, but I sort of wonder if we chased a metric and made something bad. That's what I'm wondering.
I'm sometimes worried about that, but there's even a Jeremy Keith article on this where he's runs through his fairly simple setup of how this works for him on his site, and I'm like, it's actually like it's a well-written tutorial. It's just like, yeah, I get it. That deals with the cookie thing and all that stuff. So I'll put a link to that in here for you to read. But it does, at the end of his, he gets 100 out of 100 on the site he was working on PageSpeed Insights. So it's work, though. It's work. And he uses PHP and Twig here to deal with the cookie and stuff and a grunt built to do it. But it's not that many lines of code. It seems kind of doable. And I know, Dave, your beef is legit, so...
I mean, my thing is like, I got 100 problems and this is creating like 60. So let's talk, people.
Yeah.
Let's talk insights. Meet me after school under the bridge, broomsticks. All right. Next question. Final question. Redwell Madgelter. Sorry, Redwell. Question to your guest. Sorry, I don't know which guest this was. What do you think about open source JavaScript photo galleries? Which are the best, Galleria or maybe the new Photo Swipe?
Oh yeah, it's kind of one that I'm sorry, it's probably was for a specific guest. I should have probably dropped that off at the beginning of it because it's still kind of a legit question that I think is interesting to talk about. So I think you're smart in maybe not building one for yourself. I think that this pattern, this idea that you need kind of a carousel or whatever, and first of all, we should just say, of course, you may not need a carousel. In fact, if you Google that phrase, it probably will bring up some Brad Frost something that's kind of funny and talks about how, you know, all the bad parts about carousels were, you know, the most prescient of all of them, I think, is that they solve problems in meetings, essentially. Like, everybody wants on the homepage, no problem, we'll put a carousel, everybody can be on the homepage. Okay, so that aside, sometimes you need a carousel. Sometimes it's the right thing to do. Sometimes you want to put a bunch of pictures in there, and it's actually a really nice user experience to be able to swipe through those pictures. You're an artist, you're selling prints, whatever. Sometimes it's the right thing to do, and I'm sure even Brad would agree with that. So what's the one to use? Now, that's tough, too, because you didn't list any of your kind of requirements here. So, you know, like, you kind of have to think, like, am I dealing with high-res photos here? Does it need to be any type of content? Are there going to be iframes in here? Do I need to deal with lazy loading? Do I want to deal with responsive images? Do I need to deal with responsive design? Do I need to deal with swipe and touch events and pinching and zooming? You should probably think of all your requirements before you start digging around at actual particular plugins. Yep. You know, the two that you listed, I brought up, and they seem like but I'm of course just looking. I'm looking on Chrome on my MacBook, so I look at them. I'm like, yeah, these look pretty nice. I like the little thumbnail feature here. But that's just one. Of course, the web is much more complicated than that. I don't know how responsive these are. I don't know what other features they deal with. So
I'm gonna vote Photo Swipe. I pulled this up on the Surface and swiped around on it, and it is like 100 for 100. It is really good, like really well put together. I was like, I need a photo gallery, and I was like, I think I will use this one in the future. But yeah,
the one I always think about is the just because I love David DeSandro's work, and he has his most recent kind of plugin thing under the Metaphysi universe that he makes like really well coded interesting plugin things like Isotope and Packery and Masonry and that stuff. But there's a few that are like Isotope is kind of like the fancier version of Masonry. I'm not doing a very good job of supporting him. Packery is another one. Flickety is the one that he does, and I think Flickety is the same situation, is that it's really nice on mobile. It's responsive. It's simple. It's small. It has nice APIs. Anyway.
Yeah.
It doesn't have Flickety's to be photos.
Probably a really good, just standard carousel. Like, I think the other ones are very photo carousel. This is maybe content and everything too. Like, you can do whatever you want in a carousel.
Which I think is a good, good place to be.
Yeah. Yep. Because the second you make a photo thing, somebody's going to be like, can we get text on the photo? And you're like, oh my God. And then your soul loses hit points, and then you have to go get buffed somewhere. So, all right. Well, hey, Chris, I think that's all the time we have for questions today. Let's wrap this up, shall we? You've been listening to Rapid Fire. Follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Vote us up in your podcatcher of choice. Keep sending in those questions. We like your questions.
We really do. How fun is these? I love that once we get to talk about lots of different subjects.
These are pretty refreshing episodes, and my brain gets going, and it kind of fuels me for a whole day /
week.
So thank you, everybody, and vote this up in your podcatcher of choice. Thank you for listening, and tell your friends about it, because that's how
we should read some reviews on air. Ferraris. We'll do that one of these times.
Okay, we'll read some reviews. Leave a review. Use keyword banana pants, and we'll see if we can find it. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Chris, you got anything else?
All I wanted to say was shoptalkshow.com.